Welcome to this AAT podcast, the third in the series for the 2010-11 payroll year-end returns. In the first two, I looked at submitting the annual PAYE returns, the P35, the P14s, and P38A, also reminding you about the P38S student employees return that must be completed and retained for 3 years, but does not need to be submitted to HMRC. In this podcast, I want to cover some of the other aspects that were covered in the CPD master courses, although a podcast can never provide you with the same amount of detail or the ability to ask the many questions that members from the AAT ask me on the day of the course. At the outset, let me remind you of some of the most important points covered so far, beginning with the annual return submission and the payment deadlines. The deadline for payment of any outstanding PAYE income tax, Class 1 NICs, student loan deductions, or construction industry scheme deductions is the 19th or 22nd of April 2011, a month before the statutory deadline of 19th of May 2011 for submitting the PAY returns. It is therefore important that we should be trying to reconcile the payments due for 2010-11 against the payments actually made, and doing this long before the submission deadline, so that any balance in payment can be made on time. Remember that the yellow payslip booklet, sadly changing colour to white for 2011-12, contains an additional payslip to enable us to make any additional balance in payment at the end of the year. I also want to remind you that the statutory deadline for submission of the annual PAY returns, the P35, P14s and P38A, is the 19th of May 2011. And that extra statutory concession B46 ceases to apply from the 31st of March 2011. Therefore, this means that penalties will be charged if we miss that 19th of May 2011 deadline. Clients may need to be told this if they become accustomed to providing the information after the 19th of May. The statutory deadline for issuing a P60 to employees, the end-of-year certificate of paying tax, remains at the 31st of May 2011. But one of the changes this year is that employers can now provide an electronic P60 in place of a paper form, and duplicate P60s no longer need to be marked duplicate. This may be much more convenient to some employers, especially when sending P60s to employees out in the field. HMRC, on its What's New website on the 28th of March 2011, has issued guidance in the form of an easy-to-complete email to help employers and agents notify HMRC if they have no 2010-11 employer annual returns to make. If you click on the link and move down the page, you will see that you have to provide the employer details, including the pay-as-you-earn reference, the employer name, and the postcode of the business address. We also have to provide contact details, including a contact name, full contact telephone or mobile number, and an email address. Next, we have to deal with the employer declaration, where we tick a box to confirm that I have no annual return to make, and then we must tick one of two boxes to confirm that yes, Form P11DB is due, or the box that confirms that no Form P11DB is due. You just have to complete the required details, click on Next, and once you've checked the details are correct, you then click on Submit. And please remember to keep a copy of what you've submitted to HMRC, because that will be your proof that you've told them that an annual return is not required for 2010-11. I suggest that you have a look at this, and it will help you where annual returns are not required. Perhaps where there are no earnings and no P11 deductions working sheets are required, or where the amounts paid were always below the lower earnings limit and there were no tax or NICs deductions. The other day, an AAT member asked me about a director who had drawn salary of £5,000 in the year, an amount which is below the lower earnings limit, and therefore no PAY return is required. Compare that with someone who pays themselves, say, £475 per month, just inside the earnings threshold of £476 a month, so that there's no NICs due to be deducted. But the important point is that this figure exceeds the lower earnings limit, and it is therefore necessary to submit a P35 and a P14, so that the employee or director can obtain a National Insurance Contributions credit which will count towards their future pension entitlement. I am not going to repeat the advice on checks to make of non-standard income tax code numbers and National Insurance category letters, but will just remind you that you can revisit the first Peril Your End podcast to listen to that advice again if you need to. What I now want to move on to is a more in-depth look at some potential PAYE failures that I only touched on in the first podcast. Section 2, Potential PAYE Failures. Part 1 of this year's Peril Your End podcast covered the completion and submission of the P38A Employer Supplementary Return, which is required to report details of any worker who has been employed, but where the employer has not submitted a P14 end-of-year summary or completed and retained a student form P38S. On the CPD Master Course, I have covered the issue in more detail and want to discuss it in more depth with you today. HMRC's Employer Help Book E13 tells us that an employee is anyone who is employed under a contract of services, and that this includes someone who is a full-time, part-time, and even a casual worker. It says that if the employee does not give you a P45 because they claim to be self-employed, you should look at the terms on which you took them on, and if you are in any doubt, ask your HMRC tax office for help. Of course, many employers will be sceptical about doing this, and indeed might be very reluctant to contact HMRC at all. The guidance does say that we must treat them as an employee in the meantime. There is a minimum recording requirement for PAYE, where employers must keep at least a record of the name, the address, and the amount of wages paid to each of the workers in each of the pay periods. PAYE threshold for 2010-11 is £125 per week, or £540 per month. But what we must remember is that this is effectively reduced to just £1 if a new employee, including any casual workers, has not provided a P45 from their former employer or completed a P46, ticking either box A or box B. Any worker that ticks box C on the P46, which confirms that they have another job, or perhaps a state or occupational pension, should have been taxed on code basic rate with 20% tax deductions on every pound earned in 2010-11. The complete absence of a P45 or P46 would also demand that tax at the basic rate was deducted from any payments made. There also needs to be adequate controls in place, and it is not acceptable to pay casual labour through petty cash without keeping the required records. The name, the address, and the amount paid each pay period. I've also seen payments to casual labour hidden in expenses, which is even worse than its usual home of petty cash. Wherever these costs are posted, the minimum details must be recorded. It is not good enough to complete a petty cash slip with a note of casual labour, and not even the name of the recipient. HMRC will not accept that the employer does not know who the person is that they are paying. How many businesses would be prepared to employ a stranger and allow a stranger on their premises with the potential risk to their staff and their customers? Another concern that I've been discussing with AAT members at branch meetings and on the CPD courses is the Home Office checks required on workers' entitlement to work in the UK, where potentially severe fines and even prison sentences could be imposed for failing to keep the appropriate paperwork and potentially employing, therefore, illegal workers. I have also seen examples of petty cash payments being made as top-up payments to existing employees, where they've been receiving untaxed overtime or bonuses. This is potentially very serious and could result in the employer being prosecuted. Certainly, the failure to record and report where required payments to casual labour could prove very expensive. HMRC will seek to recover basic rate tax on the full amount of any casual labour payments, plus perhaps 23.8% Class 1 national insurance contributions on any amounts in excess of the earnings threshold. To this will be added interest and penalties. And as I say, this could prove very, very costly. Well, what type of payments do we need to consider? Window cleaners are normally accepted by HMRC as being self-employed, where they, of course, provide their own ladders and other equipment to clean the windows. Office cleaners will be regarded as employees. Do we have, or can we get, a signed P46, which would eradicate or minimise the potential liability? And do we need to put them on the payroll before we close it down? Casual bar staff are often picked up by HMRC, working in pubs, clubs, etc. And very often, they are supplementing their full-time jobs. Therefore, even if a P46 were provided, it would be box C that should be ticked, if accurately completed. Tax should then be deducted at the basic rate. Casual labour may be used by different businesses covering different types of work, but the pay-as-you-earn requirements need to be adhered to, whatever the industry or type of work. What about payments to other workers that may have been brought in to provide cover or help with a big job? Sometimes I see payments to children of directors or of employees that are paid through petty cash. If they are under 16, and we should have proof of their age, then Class 1 NICs will not be an issue, because neither they nor the employer will be liable to Class 1 NICs. They may still be liable to income tax, although their income is unlikely to exceed the personal tax allowance limit, currently 6475. But I would still get a signed P46 from the teenager. Next, let me look more closely at employing student labour, where the P38S procedure might apply, but this cannot and should not be taken for granted. The P38S student employee form is the statutory return that does not have to be submitted to HMRC annually, but there is a statutory requirement to complete this form every year and to retain the completed form for at least 3 closed tax years. Completion of the P38S form allows an employer to pay a student employee without deducting income tax on any earnings up to the personal allowance limit of 6475 in 2010-11, increasing to 7475 next year, and we've just been told in the budget that it will increase to £8,105 in 2012-13. The P38S student form is only relevant to student employees who work for an employer in the school holidays. Student employees must be asked to sign the form when they're first employed. They must complete the student declaration, providing details of their name, their home address and national insurance number, plus their school or college details. They must confirm that they are a student and that they will be until the following 5th of April. And also that their total earnings will not exceed £6,475. Only if the P38S is completed can the employer operate code NT, thereby not deducting any income tax at any time in the tax year. As I've been talking to AAT members at the branches and CPD courses recently, I've been making the point that I've always had a concern and so often found the mistake made that the forms are just not completed. Well, what should we check before closing down the 2010-11 Payroll. Firstly, of the P38S forms being completed. Next, has any student been paid more than the £6,475 personal allowance limit? If they were, code OT on a week, one, or month one basis should have been applied to any amount in excess of £6,475. Remember, the P38S procedure is not relevant if payments are made to students that work in term time, outside of the school holidays. So do we need to obtain a signed P46 from any such student? And do we need to make any adjustments to the payroll? The P38S procedure is also not relevant to Class 1 NICs, which are due if the student's earnings exceed the earnings threshold. So do we need to check and make any adjustment for Class 1 NICs? However, Class 1 NICs are not due from any student employee under the age of 16. But as I said earlier, can we prove that they were under the age of 16 when we paid them? Finally, another point to remember at the payroll year end is to get the student that is working over the Easter period, which crosses two tax years, to complete another P38S for the 2011-12 tax year. In the earlier podcast, I mentioned termination payments briefly, where I always recommend a year-end check of any tax-free payments made in the year that is about to close. There are a number of issues to consider, starting with whether it was correct to make the payment without deducting income tax or Class 1 NICs. I will always tell you that it is wrong to assume that a termination payment will automatically attract the £30,000 income tax exemption in Section 401 of ITPA 2003, and also that they are not earnings for Class 1 NICs purposes. Genuine compensation or damages should be exempt within that £30,000 limit for income tax, and there should be no NICs liability, although in fact there is no exemption for Class 1 NICs purposes. The payments are either earnings which are liable to Class 1 NICs, or they are outside the definition of earnings and therefore no NICs liability arises. At the CPD Master Course, I used the example of a football manager who, according to the newspapers, was reportedly to have received £7 million compensation when sacked. Using the assumption that this was paid after the date of leaving, he would have probably been paid £7 million less tax on the excess over £30,000, in other words, 20% tax charge on £6,970,000. But there would have been no NICs liability whatsoever if the whole of the £7 million payment was non-contractual, compensation or damages, and therefore not earnings for NICs purposes. However, if there was a contractual entitlement to the element that comprised the payment in lieu of notice, that element would have been liable to both income tax and Class 1 NICs. Payments in lieu of notice and ex gratia payments are a potential minefield for employers, and it is therefore best to seek advice and perhaps clearance from HMRC before making such payments, gross and without deducting income tax or NICs. The HMRC non-statutory clearance procedure can be useful for this purpose. I am happy to assure you that any statutory redundancy payments will come within the Section 401 income tax exemption and that they will not be earnings for Class 1 NICs purposes. The maximum statutory redundancy pay that anyone could have received in 2010-11 was £12,000. That is based on 20 years service multiplied by 1.5 weeks, in other words 30 weeks, times the £400 statutory redundancy pay figure that kicked in on the 1st of February 2011. It was previously £380 per week. However, an employee earning less than £400 a week, say earning £300 per week, would receive only £300 times 30 weeks, or £9,000, they would not receive the full £400 statutory figure. The point that I must make here is that the exemption applies to genuine statutory redundancies. They would not apply if an employee retired and was given a payment, even if it was described as statutory redundancy pay. The definition of redundancy in Section 139 of the Employment Rights Act 1996 states the following. An employee who is dismissed shall be taken to be dismissed by reason of redundancy if the dismissal is attributable wholly or mainly to the fact that his employer has ceased or intends to cease to carry on the business for the purposes of which the employee was employed by him, or has ceased or intends to cease to carry on that business in the place where the employee was employed, or the fact that the requirements of that business for employees to carry out work of a particular kind, or for employees to carry out work of a particular kind in the place where he was so employed, have ceased or diminished, or expected to cease or diminish. Basically, that means that the job's gone. Either the job's gone because they've shut down, or the job's gone because they've moved from the area and the employee's no longer employed. The definition does not cover an employee retiring or leaving and being replaced. It should be applied whether the redundancy payments are statutory or non-statutory redundancy. But it is when an employer decides to top up the payments with non-statutory redundancy payments that we have to think about the £30,000 exemption limit. In carrying out an end-of-year check, I'm also concerned to ensure that any payment described as a non-statutory redundancy payment or as compensation or damages was as it was described and was not actually a contractual payment or otherwise a taxable emolument. I therefore repeat my question and ask, do we need to check that pay-as-you-earn has been operated on all contractual payments and that we haven't failed to operate PAYE on wrongly described termination payments? Next, let me say more about potential problems where an individual has been treated as self-employed. And should we satisfy ourselves that this is correct? HMRC will always say that employment status is not a matter of choice, either for the individual or for the engager or potential employer. It is often a difficult issue, and perhaps it is difficult to draw the line between employment and self-employment. But unless it is clear that someone is self-employed and in business in their own right, I will ask the question as to what checks are being carried out to satisfy us that pay-as-you-earn did not have to be operated. Do we now need to put them on the payroll before we close it down? The HMRC online employment status indicator tool is not foolproof, but I will always use it. And if it gives me the right answer of self-employment, when I have answered all the questions truthfully, fully, and correctly, I know that it will be binding on HMRC, and I will keep a copy of that response on file for a future inspection. We also have the clearance option of asking HMRC to give us a decision. But if I refer you back to the Help Book E13 guidance, we are told that we have to operate pay-as-you-earn if in doubt and until we are told otherwise. So the risk is there. There is no time in this podcast to go through a lot of specific types of work. But I have already mentioned that HMRC accepts that window cleaners are self-employed and will not accept that an individual office cleaner is anything other than employee. Non-executive directors may be treated as self-employed for income tax, but they are officers by regulation because officers are treated as employed earners for Class 1 NICs. So let me ask the question. Have the non-executive director's fees been treated correctly? Or do we need to make an adjustment before the year end for Class 1 NICs on those director's fees? It could be that director's fees for acting as and providing services as a director are paid in addition to consultancy fees, which can properly be treated as self-employed income. But will this pass the scrutiny of an HMRC inspection? Is there a dual contract in place? Is there a genuine consultancy there? And can we prove that? Section 3. Payzuan changes. The first thing I want to look at is the changes to Payzuan regulations for tax codes, which will apply from the 6th of April 2011. This is quite an important change. And what we're going to have is that code OT or 0T is to be operated instead of the standard code basic rate, code BR. The problem with code BR is that it deducts 20% whether the individual is paid £1 or £7 million. However, code 0T is no allowances like code BR, but after the allowances and the basic rate band, which for next year is £35,000, code OT will then deduct tax at the higher rate of 40% up to the £150,000 limit, and then at 50% thereafter. The changes that HMRC have made by changing the regulations affect a number of different type of employee. Firstly, let me look at the new employee without a P45. Currently, if a new employee fails to provide a P45, a form P46 is required to determine the tax code. Emergency code can be used if box A or box B is ticked, but code basic rate has to be used if box C is ticked, which confirms, as I said earlier, that there is other employment or perhaps a state or occupational pension. The use of code 0T as the new requirement should avoid large underpayments arising for high-paid employees. I've given AAT members at the branches the example of a client of mine who joined the employer in August one year when everyone was on holiday and the P45 wasn't dealt with. He was stuck on code BR and he stayed on code BR for over a year because the payroll department didn't notice and the revenue never issued a tax code amendment. His earnings were over £100,000 a year and he ended up owing something like £15,000 in tax. The use of code OT would avoid that problem. The next change will affect payments after the date of leave-in, where currently employers are required to deduct tax at the basic rate. For payments made after the date of leave-in and the issue of the P45, of course. However, from 6th of April 2011, employers are required to deduct tax using code 0T. And as I've said already, income tax will then be deducted at the basic rate, followed by the higher rate, and then the additional rate of 50% after £150,000. This may have a negative effect for some employees who have left and don't get another job. For example, someone leaving at the end of December will not get their personal allowances for January, February and March. And if they don't get another job, they will perhaps end up with a repayment to be claimed after the end of the tax year. Next, the change will affect employers who are paying an employee both pay and a pension. The current guidance is to continue using the same tax code number against the pay and the pension until HMRC issues a new tax code. That would effectively mean that double allowances were being given. This can result in employees receiving too many personal allowances and having an underpayment of tax that can be even more difficult for pensioners. From April 2011, the authorised code to be operated against the occupational pension will be changed to code OT when the employee continues to work for that employer. We're awaiting full guidance on this from HMRC, which is due to be published in April. Next, I just want to mention the general uplift of tax codes with suffix L. So, for example, emergency code will change from 647L to 747L, and anyone with an L code will get an increase of 100 in their tax code. The instructions for employers will be issued on Form P9X 2011, and you can go to the Business Link website for more information on this. HMRC have been issuing tax codes between January and March this year, and they've now introduced the new tax code D1 to apply from 6th of April 2011. The next point I want to discuss is salary sacrifice, which has become very popular in recent years and is being looked at the moment by many advisers to reduce the high marginal rates of tax for their high-earner clients. It can be used to preserve personal allowances of people in the marginal tax band above 100,000, where the personal allowance is reduced by £1 for every £2 over £100,000. Someone earning £112,590 would pay tax of £38,240, compared to only £30,470 if their earnings were £100,000. The suggestion has been made that sacrificing £12,950 of pay for an increased employer pension contribution would therefore save £7,770 tax. I'm not claiming to be a financial advisor, so I would advise any client to take financial advice on that point. But a point I want to make is that salary sacrifice is a contractual matter between the employee and the employer, and therefore care needs to be exercised to ensure that it is effective. The paperwork must be correct, and it must be in place before the sacrifice is made. Indeed, I have concerns sometimes that there's any paperwork at all. The contract must be changed before the benefit is provided to the employees. And employees should be advised that sacrifice in salary may have an impact on any statutory payments, state pension, tax credits, etc. We should remember that the calculation of statutory payments is based on earnings that are liable to Class 1 NICs. Next, I want to look at the changes to employer-supported childcare, where tax relief is to be restricted to basic rate tax from the 6th of April 2011. The good news for any employees currently in a salary sacrifice scheme for childcare is that they won't be affected, whether they pay tax at basic rate, higher rate or additional rate. But for any new employees joining a scheme after the 5th of April 2011, there is a restriction of tax relief which will apply. A basic rate taxpayer will get tax relief on the full £55 per week, £243 per month, or £2,915 per annum. A higher rate taxpayer will have their tax relief restricted to £28 per week, or £124 per month, or £1,484 per annum. And then any additional rate 50% taxpayer will only get tax relief at £22 per week, £97 per month, or £1,166 per annum. As I've said, existing employees in a scheme will continue to enjoy tax relief at their highest tax rate on £55 per week or £243 a month. I can also confirm that the restriction does not affect the exemption for workplace nurseries. So how is this going to work, and why is it such a concern for AAT members and their clients? The requirement of HMRC is that employers will have to assess basic earnings for a full tax year at the start of the tax year. My concern is that many employers will be totally unaware of this requirement. The basic earnings assessment is done using the known pay-as-you-earn tax code, and adding to that the basic rate band, which for next year is 35,000. So, for example, code 747L is 7,475 allowances plus £35,000 basic rate band. So we work on the figure of 42,475. And someone earning above that will have their tax relief restricted. Employers should count contracted basic pay, bonuses, weighting, taxable benefits and shift allowances, but should ignore performance-related and discretionary bonuses, overtime, and any exempt benefits. There will be no requirement to make any in-year changes, whether there's promotions or pay rises. And employers should ignore P45 figures for joiners, and instead use an annualised notional figure. The situation of tax and NIC for new joiners from 6th of April 2011 is that the basic rate taxpayer will get full relief on the £55 per week. There will be no payroll adjustment or P11D reporting for a basic rate taxpayer. However, for a higher rate taxpayer, relief will be limited to £28 per week, and for an additional rate taxpayer, relief will be limited to £22 per week. Whether childcare is employer-contracted childcare, and in other words, this is a benefit in kind, we will report the £27 or £33 excess on Form P11D at Section M of the P11D in the brown box. Now, this is reporting for 2011-12, not for the P11Ds that we're about to do. If we have childcare vouchers, there will be a Class 1 NIC's liability. So we would report £27 excess or £33 excess at Section C of the Form P11D in the blue box section. However, we will have to deduct Class 1 NICs through the payroll, and that Class 1 NICs deduction will start any time from the 6th of April 2011 for any new employees who join a childcare scheme from that date onwards. Next section summary. Well, folks, that's the end of a series on Payroll Year End for 2010-11. And I hope that when you have the chance, you'll be able to listen to all of the podcasts and that they will be useful to you. We've covered the actual submission of the end of year returns. We've looked at online filing for the end of year returns, registration for online filing, and also the online filing for in-year returns, which will apply from the 6th of April. In this podcast, we've looked at some of the difficult areas related to casual labour and self-employment, and we've looked at some of the changes taking place next year in terms of code OT replacing code BR and the problems in employer-supported childcare. I hope that once you've had the chance to listen to all the podcasts, you will have found it very useful. And I thank you for listening.